Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Above Politics Show. Guess what today, folks? My co-host and friend Homer Fife can't be with us today. But what I've done is I've scouted around the ATS community and I've managed to track down ATS member Budsky, who is going to join us in the show. How are you, Budsky?
I'm not too bad, thank you very much.
Good. Well,
looking forward to it. Slightly nervous, but looking forward to a good discussion.
Hey, well, I want to thank you for stepping in to help us out with the show. And I know you and I were just talking about some things we wanted to talk about, and I think something fairly topical across the world has been the G20 summit meeting in the UK over the last couple of days, which I know certainly from a UK perspective has been marred with some violence, probably not associated directly with the G20, but also at some of the banks. So I just sort of see if you had any thoughts on the G20.
Well, I think when you look at banks and politicians in particular, to use a kind of anecdote, if a football team was getting beaten 10-0 in every match and the manager turned around and said they were all great players and they were all trying really hard and they deserved the wages and they deserved the bonuses, then the supporters of that club would quite rightly be up in arms. I mean, my point is, why should that be any different for bankers and politicians? They've dropped the ball, but they've rewarded themselves for dropping the ball, and now we're picking up the slack. And I don't really generally see that as a good thing. In fact, I see that as an absolute disgrace, to be fair.
I mean, I think I'd sort of implicitly agree with you there, Budsky, but I would turn it round a little bit and say, if a bank hasn't taken any money from a government or from taxpayers, then I really don't care what they've done. I mean, you've got in the UK, you've got HSBC and you've got Barclays who have not taken any money from the British taxpayer. I really don't care if they want to reward their staff horrendous bonuses. We can argue about the moral and efficacy of that, but that's slightly different. It's when they've come cap in hand to, you know, the British taxpayer, to the American taxpayer, to the French taxpayer, to the German taxpayer, to the Dutch taxpayer, and on around the world. I absolutely agree with you then. There is no justification for any kind of bonuses when your business has been run so appallingly badly that governments around the world have had to bail you out.
Absolutely. You know, if a bank's doing well, if they're making profits, if they're solvent, then what they do and what their shareholders do with their money is their business. Some of us might find, you know, a bonus of £5 million obscene. But if the shareholders, the CEOs, etc., are prepared to pay that bonus, then based on performance especially, then that's their business. But as you say, when they come cap in hand to basically the taxpayer, and they then want to get rewarded for failure, I find that a little bit off-putting. I don't think that plausible at all.
No, and, you know, we only saw some of the cases in the US where, you know, with one hand, members of the administration knew that vast bonuses were going to be paid to AIG, and then on the other hand you've got members of the House of Representatives saying, right, we want to put a bill forward that's going to tax them 90%. I think classic example of the left and right hand of government not being entirely sure what the other hand is doing.
Absolutely. I mean, to interject a kind of conspiracy angle here, when Tony Blair first became Prime Minister, he sponsored the FTC, which is a foreign relations kind of institute. It's actually called the Foreign Policy Centre, and it's another one of these think tank drug quangos that sprang up all around under Labour. And it was launched in 1998 under the patronage of Tony Blair. When he left office, he immediately went to work. One of his jobs was for J.P. Morgan. And we know about J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, those kind of conspiracies. And he was earning something around about £500,000 a year as a consultant. Over the next year or two, we started to see the crisis, or posed crisis, unfold at a time when Tony Blair was a consultant and after he'd set up a think tank whose avowed goal was to look at various ways of world governance, globalization, and some people would see that as new world order. Now, I find all this very kind of convenient for all these coincidences. conferences to be going on around the same time. When you consider that the Council on Foreign Relations in America, excuse me, got a bit of a cold, brought out a program titled the International Institutions and Global Governance Program, which utilizes the resource of the David Rockefeller Studies Program to also assess global governance mechanisms. Now, with that in mind, I'm always wondering, I'm not a hardcore conspiracy theorist, but when you look and think about all these little coincidences and connect the dots a little bit, they all kind of add up, especially when you consider the amount of deregulation that happened in the UK at the time when Blair came into office.
I think that's a very good point when you think about what's come out of the G20, you know, the fact that there's this global program to potentially spend $1 trillion, that the, you know, these G20 countries, which should have spanned the whole world in reality, have agreed to start thinking to have a common banking infrastructure or a common banking regulation structure, and are going to go after tax havens. You're right, you can start to see, if you were a conspiracy theory and an absolute end, you know, new world order nut here, Budsky, that, you know, this is just, you know, another hand that the New World Orderists are playing to get what they want. But in some respects, do we not have to have that to enable the world to develop as, you know, a single entity? Because can we actually do the things that we may need to do in the next 50 to 100 years, which is potentially start leaving this planet and exploring the rest of the solar system? Can we actually do that when we're squabbling, when we don't have common government, common regulation across the world?
Well, I'm one of these people who doesn't necessarily see a new world order as a bad thing. New world order has a lot of nasty connotations because a lot of people see any kind of conspiracy theory as a bad thing. And, you know, when Labour first came into power, we had the whole kind of racism, Little England, political correctness thing, all went a bit wild. Now, in some ways, that was a good thing because we do need to be brought together. We do need acceptance. We do need to work together as a planet. The problem that I see with it really is one of accountability. We've seen with the present government, with previous government, with the European Union, that there is a real lack of accountability there. And this is what I see as the major, major problem. If we can't even hold politicians in our own country accountable, how on earth can we hold accountable people who are globally governing us?
I think, you know, that's a very interesting point. Now, I mean, certainly, I suppose I'd turn that around a little bit and say we can hold politicians accountable because, you know, every 4 or 5 years we have the ability to say that we don't think you're doing a job and we want to vote someone else in. But I can see your point. Certainly, there are certain, you know, parts of the EU that are totally beyond accountability, and that I have and you have and anybody else in the EU has no say in certain parts of the EU that make huge decisions. And I suspect that's the same in the States as well. When you think about, you know, organizations like FEMA, for example, and the FBI, you know, they're not actually directly accountable to the people of the United States. They're accountable to the government and the executive. It probably makes it very hard to actually say to somebody, well, I'm not happy with what you're doing with FEMA, what you're doing with, you know, a European single policy on defense, on foreign relations, if those people aren't accountable. But the other question is, if you make things more accountable, are people going to take less risks? Because they're going to be thinking, well, I'm subject to accountability. I may be getting voted on every 6 months rather than every 5 years. I'm only going to do what makes me popular, so I'm in office in the next 6 months.
One of the issues here comes down to trust, and over the last couple of generations, we certainly in the West completely lost trust in our politicians, and there are very, very good reasons for that. And this is where certainly my concerns lie, and I'm sure other people's concerns lie. It always comes down to an issue of trust. If a policy is unpopular but it's done for the common good, then I don't have a problem with it. I mean, looking you know, further ahead, in business terms, you'd have a short-term plan, a mid-term plan, and a long-range plan. And certainly I think that governments function in the same way. With the EU Constitution, we'll call it that just for simplicity's sake, the new treaty, I don't think that people are looking beyond their own borders. I think the politicians have a vision to bring us all together, and the people don't like it. Now, in many, many many ways, you know, we have to start doing that as European, as, you know, in the Americas, in Asia. Now, you will get the power blocks as they are perceived by people, but eventually all these power blocks will coalesce. And I believe that's what's starting to happen now. We're starting to see, instead of individual countries, we're starting to see blocks of countries. Those blocks of countries will eventually coalesce into a single world government. And like I say, I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing. We have to move forwards as a species. You know, we have to stop killing each other. We have to stop war. We have to stop hunger. We have to stop poverty, and the only way to do that is for everybody to work together. But, and it is a very big but, it all comes back to accountability, and at the moment there's very little. You know, you say about you can vote politicians out after 4 or 5 years. Well, in reality, everybody knew that Labour in its first and second term weren't really doing that great a job, but there wasn't really any other choice, and they knew that there wasn't any other choice, and that's where there was a lack of accountability. You may even call it, or tie it in with, complacency.
But then how do you change that? How do you then say, you know, because clearly I think, you know, accountability and complacency and lack of voter turnout, you could probably say, Budski, are all tied together here. You know, I make it a personal point that every election, be it a parish election, a district election, council, or a general, or a constituency, or a general, I make the personal point that I go and vote. But I think there are a lot of people, not only in the UK, but across the world, who, you know, don't take time to vote. I mean, if you look at the statistics for the US presidential elections, you know, probably because Barack Obama was the candidate, I suspect more people turned out and voted in that than if it had been two white middle-aged men who were battling it out for the presidency.
Well, there again, you know, you're making a very good point there. And I think that a lot more people turned out in the black communities in America because in previous times they hadn't had a candidate that they felt they could identify with. They felt it was just more of the same status quo. Why should I vote? Now, he spoke to people and we got a good turnout for those elects. And that brings me on to the point of individual responsibility. I mean, in years gone by, people have died and fought for our right to vote. Now, I would always exercise my right to vote, even if that's just going into the ballot box, spoiling the paper, because I don't think any of them are worth vote for. I would still exercise my right to. And you're very right, we have to take responsibility as individuals and have a voice, because that voice is there. And if you don't use it, then really you can't complain about the consequence.
And I think you're right there, and I think that always begs the argument here for the classic Eddie Murphy film, you know, vote for none of the above, which I know why people won't do that, but I always think it would be interesting to see how many people would vote for none of the above. But the other thing that then that says is, then I would maintain that it should be a legal requirement to vote. I mean, you look at Australia, it's a democratic country, their election turnouts are in the high 90s, I think even 99%. They say everyone has to vote. If you were to go down that model, I would say you also then have to have a box on there that says, I don't think any of these candidates are fit to serve me.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and that's a very good point. And it does, at the end of the day, come down to choices. You know, you can choose to vote or not to vote. Personally, looking at history and everything else, then I would never give up my right to vote. I might spoil the ballot or just not vote, but I still exercise my democratic right. And I think that more people need to do that in order to not necessarily get what they want, but to have a voice, to make themselves heard, to make their opinions heard. Because if you don't vote, if you don't go out and take up your democratic right, then how can you complain when something goes wrong?
And you're right. And yeah, I don't think you can disagree with that as an argument. I think people will always argue and say, oh, I have the right to moan. I don't have the right. I don't have to vote. And I fully accept that. I think that's an absolute fundament. But I suppose one of the other things I'm interested in is, do you think that the $1 trillion investment package that came out of the G20 is actually going to change anything, do anything? Or do you think that's just words and that's what people expected them to do?
I think it's hot air. basically, okay. I can't see really how that would make a difference. In the left-leaning French daily Libération, if I'm saying it right, they said, words have changed, now we have to judge on act. And I think that's a fair point. Les Echos said, if it's not exactly a world government, it's much more than a summit. Le Figaro said it was the symphony of a new world.
But
and
then
there's many more instances of that.
But then if you think with the structures that we've had in the past, it doesn't seem like those have worked very well. If you look at the, you know, the fact that, you know, more money than is decent than you and I could probably even conceive of personally has been spent on bailing out banks and financial institutions, one could make the argument to say, well, the old way has failed. Is it not time for us to try another way? And you were just sort of, I know you mentioned the Libération, the French paper. I mean, you know, France has always, to my mind, been at the very, you know, centre of Europe and has been very pro-Europe, but then you see that some of the French car makers are closing factories in other EU countries and bringing the jobs back to France, which does always make a mockery, to my mind, of having an organisation such as the EU, which is meant to be, you know, common and free trade, and you've got members now squabbling to say, well, I'm closing my factories in Eastern Europe because I'm bringing the jobs home.
Absolutely, and that's one of the major problems. I mean, I agree about France. It's since the time of the revolution, really, and Napoleon, where France has felt itself to be at the centre of Europe. But what the French have always done is look after France first. And in some ways, you've got to admire that. But in other ways, to make an organisation like the EU work as it should work, as it was envisaged to work when it started to become a political entity rather than just a free trade market, then people have to work together. And time again, we see that countries just look after their own interests. In my part of the world, the fishing industry has been hit very, very hard. And one of the reasons for this is because Spanish fishermen were allowed to fish in what are basically UK waters. Now, they ignored quotas. And they ignored quotas because the Spanish authorities were never going to enforce them. And I see this a lot, and I may be very wrong when I say this, but I see all these EU regulations and laws, and sometimes it seems to me that the UK are the only ones that abide by them. And it's always the little people that get hurt. The French look after their farming industry to, you know, the max that they can. And, you know, the farming industry as well, because I live in a very rural area, has been hit very hard. And yet the French farmers are doing very well. So there's all these little things, and you could name hundreds of instances where isolationism, or a form of isolationism, if you like, or protectionism, becomes a key role. I mean, we know, in the UK, we laugh a lot about the French, they'll riot at the drop of a hat. And the politicians over there are very conscious of that. And they look after their own first, without a second thought to the rest of the EU. And they're basically turning around and saying, you know, sticking two fingers up at the rest of us and going, well, we're going to look after our own. And, you know, if a one world government was to be put in place, there's absolutely no way that it could work that way. Everybody has to work together. And I think it's time that people started looking beyond boundaries, because let's face it, most of the borders in the world today are artificial. They've been created by politics and by politicians for self-interest and self-gain of their own populations. I really do think it's time we moved past that.
Except, of course, for the English Channel, which needs to remain there.
Well, yeah, I mean, the French call it something else, but it will always be the English Channel, because any time that anybody tried to take it away from us, we thanked them.
Quite right. And if you agree or disagree with anything that Budsky or myself have said, or you've got a view that you want to put across, just go and find the show thread. And I know, just sort of touching on the accountability issue, I know in the UK we've been having great fun with our Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, who has been caught, I'm going to be quite brutal here, defrauding the British taxpayer by someone claimed in a second home for watching some movies, and a couple of them were pornographic. You know, you can say, well, why was he looking at pornography, blah blah blah. I think the fundamental issue here is that maybe we have caught the sniff of what a lot of MPs potentially may be doing, which is ripping off the British taxpayer.
Well, in the first instance, and I'm going to be quite mean here, I would say that he was looking at pornography because he's married to Jack Nair.
Oh, now, if you're... Remember, all those lawyers out there, Budsky said that and no one else. You're right, yes, you can be very cruel and harsh on this one. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you on this one.
Well, MPs in the UK no longer work for the people, now work for their own enrichment. And to paraphrase Douglas Adams, anybody whose ambition it is to be a politician should automatically be banned from becoming one. They're now career politicians.
But then if you go back potentially maybe 300 years, certainly in the United Kingdom, you know, where you had sort of rotten boroughs, you know, where, you know, the landed gentry got in there because he basically told all his serfs and workers, if you didn't vote for me and I didn't get elected, things were going to be unpleasant. I don't know how you can change that, in the fact that, you know, who wants to stand and be an MP these days? How are you going to govern if you don't have elected officials?
Well, career politician, it is a career choice. When Gordon Brown and Tony Blair and, you know, the little gang there, they all knew each other either during university or just after university. And they had a very definite plan in mind. This plan took a long time to come to fruition, and they became career politicians. There are good things in that, certainly, because you get to know the system, you get to know how things work. But I also think that there's an element of self-serving in there. And until people can elect politicians that are not self-serving, then we're always going to have this problem. I mean, there's the instance in Prime Minister's Question Time this week, and I look at this as parliamentary collusion. There was a big opportunity there in Prime Minister's Question Time to question the Home Secretary's motives, not only in, you know, the husband looking at pornography, but the fact that she was claiming her sister's house 9 miles, I think it is, away, as her second home or her primary home. I forget where.
I think she's claiming her sister's as her primary home and then her home in Redditch as her second home.
So she's introduced, you know, widescreen TVs, brand new fitted kitchens. She's doing all this for her sister, who's not a politician, and we're paying for it.
I'd like
to come back to that parliamentary collusion.
Sure.
The opportunity was there for them to question and for them to really have a proper pop at, but they really didn't want to do it because they're all guilty of the same thing.
And I think you've touched on the absolute reason why they didn't do that, because, you know, potentially mud might stick all round. But I still think, how do you get away from having career politicians? I mean, you certainly look at in the United Kingdom, and, you know, you look in the US at, you know, Ted Kennedy, at, you know, people like Tony Wedgwood Benn. You know, some of these people have been in politics, have been re-elected for, you know, 20 or 30 years. Maybe we have to have something that says, you know, like US presidents can only stand for a certain number of offices. Maybe we need to think about that for our elected officials, to say you can only ever serve 2 terms, so that you try.
One of the notes that I have written down here is limited term. So it's a possibility. It is a possibility.
But then
always go back, though, to the TV series Yes Minister and Prime Minister.
An absolute classic.
Where, I mean, who pulls the strings here?
Well, you have to think that, you know, I was liked Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, because clearly it wasn't the politicians pulling the strings.
Exactly, and it does make you think a little bit. I mean, you know, I think that the real career politicians are the civil servants, especially the Whitehall Mandarins, as we call them. They will explain, as we saw in Yes Prime Minister and Yes Minister, when a minister wants to do something, they'll explain the real politics of the situation. And very often a politician will want to do something but won't be able to because of what they see as the consequences, and a lot of the time the consequences are not getting re-elected.
And you know, I think that's a very valid point. I mean, I just wanted to just move slightly around the world a little bit and just sort of on your limited terms. You know, if we look at a country like Israel, for example, I don't suppose you could have legislation that limited the terms, a number of terms that a prime minister could actually sit for, because you think in the last 15 years, they've probably, you know, they've had prime ministers come and go. So if you said that you could only have a prime minister with two or three terms in Israel, we probably wouldn't have Benjamin Netanyahu as the prime minister today.
No, but I mean, you know, Israel is a country that doesn't necessarily compute on the in the same way that other countries do. I mean, it's a totally unique situation, and it seems to me sometimes that you either have somebody who's moderate or you have somebody who's very, very hard line. I haven't yet made my mind up where Benjamin Netanyahu falls. He could be seen as moderate compared to others. But yeah, if he was a Western politician, we may then see him more hardline.
And I think he would certainly be seen probably more on the sort of on the right. But I suppose one of the interesting things about Israel, it has proportional representation, and it just goes to show that, you know, smaller parties typically have a lot more power. You only have to look at Italy, for example, is another country that has proportional representation, and people hold Israel, they hold Italy up as, you know, depending on which side of the proportional representation debate you want to sit. Some will say here's an example of why proportional representation is good and why it isn't bad, but I just think it is very interesting. You know, you've even got the foreign minister of Israel sort of saying the Annapolis Accord probably doesn't mean anything anymore, and I just think that's an incredibly interesting thing to say, and I suspect there could be some interesting conversations taking place behind closed doors between Benjamin Netanyahu and Lieberman, his foreign minister.
Well, I think that this is one of the problems that we have with the world today, with organisations like the Bilderberg Group. You could even say the G20. There's been an awful lot that's gone on behind closed doors that we're not party to, and in some respects, then we really shouldn't be party to it, because hard decisions have to be made. You know, a lot of people might not like what they hear, but I'll come back to accountability. To my mind, and I understand why it's done, but to my mind, politicians shouldn't be talking to each other behind closed doors. They should be saying what's best for us, what's best for our people, what's best for the people of the world, how can we implement that, and how can we tell the people that. And they should be doing that in an open and frank manner, not doing little cosy deals behind closed doors, because it becomes like a little club. I used to call it a cosy club, where they all know each other, they all know each other's little things, they all know which button press on the other guy. So, okay, if you do this for me, I'll do that for you. But then you've got to do this for me, and then I'll do that for you. And that's not what they were elected for. They weren't elected to put their own personal vision of what we should be doing. They weren't elected to make behind closed deals that might not be in the best interest of whichever group they belong to, whether that's the UK, whether that's the EU, whether that's an Asian trade bloc, whether that's a North American trade bloc. I mean, whichever way you look at it, what we should be doing is having open and frank discussion in full view of everybody as to which way we go, not only as a country, not only as a continent, but as a species. And, you know, when things are done behind closed doors, everybody wonders what's gone on. How are we going to pay for this? What do we owe for them falling into line with what we want? And it could all be very innocent. But on the other side of the coin, it could not be, or it might not be.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. And I know we're coming smack on time here. So if you've agreed or disagreed with anything that Budsky and I have said, go and find the show thread and post away. And certainly, Budsky, I want to thank you for stepping in to the breach, so to speak. And I've got to say, I enjoyed it. It was fun. And hopefully Homer will be back next week. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And it was quite an honour to be asked.
Well, it's my pleasure. And on behalf of Homer, I have been Martin Bain. And we'll see you next time on the Above Politics Show.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com.
The views expressed on the Above Politics show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.